योगेन चित्तस्य पदेन वाचां मलं शरीरस्य च वैदिकेन योपाकरोत्तं प्रवरं मुनीनां पतञ्जलिं प्राञ्जलिरानतोऽस्मि। स्तुवे पतञ्जलिं व्यासं शङ्करं च मुनित्रयं कर्तृसूत्रस्य भाष्यस्य क्रमाद्विवरणस्य च। सो ऐ विल् ट्रै टु एक्स्प्लेन् दिस् टु वर्सस् विच् आर् नार्मलि चाण्टेड् अट् द बिगिनिङ्ग् आफ् any discussion on yoga sutras from once because frequently we have to remember that. So this book, yoga text, is the bible of yoga as a whole, not only yoga philosophy, yoga psychology, but also even the physical aspects of yoga. It is in the form of aphorisms. An aphorism is a small, pithy statement which may not be in the form of a full sentence. It could be just a phrase or one or two words put together. By itself, they may not be very easy to understand. They can be understood only with the help of interpretations and commentaries. Altogether, there are 8 classical commentaries written in Sanskrit on yoga text. The whole text contains 195 aphorisms. As I mentioned, an aphorism is a small statement. Very often it may be a long sentence, or it could be in the form of a phrase or one or two, three words put together. Is divided into 4 chapters. The first chapter chronologically deals with the science of contemplation, higher meditation. It's called Samadhipada, means the discussion on Samadhi. The second chapter deals with the means and methods and practices that we have to undertake to reach this level of higher concentration. The third chapter deals with some of the psychological powers, psychic powers that we normally develop through this higher concentration. One point that I used to stress again and again was this: there is no miracle in this. There is no accident. It's purely scientific. Just as we develop some skills at a physical level through constant practice with great concentration, so also when we turn this concentration inward, our mind develops certain skills and powers which can be scientifically and psychologically explained. So that third chapter deals with Vibhutipada, which means the chapter dealing with the psychic powers or the results of these practices. The fourth chapter deals with liberation, the highest spiritual liberation. It's called Kaivalyapada. So this is the structure of the text. 195 sutras, small aphorisms, divided into 4 chapters. Now, if you look at any printed book, it begins with concentration, and the next chapter is the means and methods for reaching that concentration. So you can see there is a little discrepancy, you know, some kind of a mismatch. And the third chapter deals with the psychic powers that you develop as a result of yogic practices. Even hatha yoga, physical exercises that you develop in the yoga studios, you see, dasana, for example, develops certain kinds of mental focus, powers, which is quite obvious. Sishasana, Siddhasana, some of these are well-known postures which are said to develop some powers which are not purely physical, but also deals with the psychological skills, so to speak. And the fourth chapter is liberation. So in order to make them more or less in tune with their actual practice, I have dealt with the means and methods and practices first, and then the results, and then the concentration, and fourth, of course, liberation. This is the structure of the text. The text was written by a great psychologist, philosopher, Patanjali. That's the name of the great text. The yoga practices, physical exercises that you do in yoga studios. These yogic postures are not at all discussed in Patanjali system. Patanjali uses only one important sthira sukham asana, definition of asana. Means a posture that helps you to develop the skill to sit straight in a relaxed mood for a long time for concentration, which is a necessary posture, a convenient posture for a practice of meditation or concentration. But this physical exercise part was developed by some other later thinkers and sages, and they wrote some well-known books. Gheranda is the name of a saint, so he wrote a book called Gheranda Samhita. Another well-known book is Hatha Yoga Pratipika. These are the two famous books. And the third one is Shiva Samhita. These are the three important textbooks which can be called together the Bible of modern yogic practices, which are not really discussed in Patanjali system. Patanjali looks upon yoga as a means not for physical health alone, but for higher spiritual liberation, and also as a means and methods for us to study why we behave and act and speak and live the way we are doing. We will be able to understand, we will be able to get an insight into our own inner character, inner structure. That is what you find in Patanjali system. So, the first verse deals with Patanjali. We bow down, we are paying a tribute, a respect to the great sage Patanjali. Patanjalim Pranjali Ranatosmi. I bow down, I pray to the sage Patanjali for writing this famous book so that we can study all this today. So, he wrote three important books. He made three important contributions to human life. First, he wrote this yoga text to help us to purify our mind, to elevate our mind, to understand the functions and methods and thought currents that are going on in our mind, and to get an insight into our own character, our own nature. So for that, chittasya mala means to remove the dirt and filth of mind. That's literally what it means. Mala means what you throw out. So mind has got many impurities in the form of thoughts, impressions, memories, which we do not want, which we want to get rid of, but we are not able to. Patanjali will help you to purify, to cleanse our mind. So for that he wrote a famous book, that is this yoga text. Then he made another great contribution. He also wrote a book to help us to purify our speech, to use proper words, to use proper words in a proper manner, correctly, not only in terms of grammar, but also in terms of its effect. So, he wrote a famous commentary, a huge commentary on the text of Sanskrit grammar, that is Panini's Ashtadhyayi, which is a very huge and very important text which he completed in 9th century BC. That's a text, the fundamental text of Sanskrit grammar, which is completed, it is standardized in 9th century BC. So Patanjali wrote a big commentary, an exposition of the grammatical rules laid down by Panini. That's the second contribution, means to purify our speech, our usage of language. Then he wrote a great commentary on one of the famous Ayurveda texts, Sushruta Suktas, which is one of the ancient Indian school of medicine, ancient Ayurveda. It's a natural cure. So he made these three contributions. This is the essence of the first verse. The second verse is a tribute that we paid to three great sages associated with this Patanjali's text, Yoga Sutra text. The first one is Patanjali himself, who wrote the sutras. Then we are remembering with great respect, we are remembering Vyasa, who wrote a commentary on Patanjali's text. Because all the great ideas that we derive from Patanjali's text, Patanjali's sutras, we got through Vyasa, who was a great commentator, who wrote an exposition of Patanjali's text. So, and the third great sage was who lived in 8th century, Shankaracharya, who is the greatest of Vedantic scholars, maybe the greatest philosopher, sage of India. He wrote a commentary on Vyasa's commentary. See, these are the three great sages associated with yoga tradition, which is called Munitrayam, means three great sages and philosophers who expounded yoga text for the benefit of humanity. So that is the essence of these verses which I chanted at the very beginning. Now we will continue the discussion from where we left last week. So we should remember where we left last week. So there is a description of, there is a definition of yoga, as I already mentioned, that comes in the second sutra, that is Yogaha Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga means controlling, purifying, regulating our mental functions, the residual elements, the samskaras, memories, impressions, and so on. And then fourth sutra mentions one important fact which we already discussed. What is that? If we do not practice yoga, what happens? When we practice yoga, we are able to live in the world, we are able to interact with other, with different experiences within our mind and also experiences outside, without being affected by them. That's what happens when we practice yoga, when we turn to yoga. But if you do not try to practice yoga, what happens? Every single insignificant event, experience that happens within our mind or in the external world will have a devastating effect on our character. The smallest problem will appear to be a big tragedy. Because our mind assumes the form of what it interacts with, what it imbibes from external world. When an unhappy event takes place, it shatters the mind because we completely identify ourselves with the person undergoing that unhappy experience. If there is a happy experience, then also we completely identify with that. If we always try to look for happiness, the result will be total disappointment. Because happiness and unhappiness are two sides of the same coin. We cannot have a coin with only one side. Every happiness at the external level, sensory level, will come to an end very soon. So, when the happiness disappears, what is left is its opposite, unhappiness. So they come and go in waves as a result of this identification with experiences. In this context, there is a famous statement in Vyasa's commentary, which I referred to. Vyasa describes how mind becomes totally helpless when we interact with the external world. How the mind functions is mentioned here. The Sanskrit commentary is this. चित्तमपि अयः सदृशविषयज तत्तस्य स्वस्मिन् सन्निधिमात्र दृश्यत्वम् उपकारं कुर्वत् पुरुषस्य स्वामिनः भोगसाधनत्वात् स्वं भवति भोगसाधनत्वात्। अनदर वन, चित्तम अयस्कान्तमणिकल्पसन्निधिमात्रोपकारी दृश्यत्वेन स्वं भवति पुरुषस्य स्वामिनः। हियर द कमेंटेटर व्यासः compares our mind into a magnet. So I may read these commentaries. I know that many of you won't be able to follow, but I will give an extended translation, interpretation, so that even if you don't listen to Sanskrit dissertation, you won't lose anything. So what Vyasa says is this: our mind is like a magnet. So why it is called a magnet? What happens? Due to close proximity, it becomes the property of the master. Means whatever happens around us, it gets attracted towards the mind. Our mind also gets attracted towards that. So there is this mutual attraction. So when we do not practice yoga, when we do not practice higher wisdom, when we do not understand the spirit of yoga practice, what happens? Every single happening, event, episode around us will immediately be hooked into our mind. We can never have any experience and forget about it. Whenever we experience something with full consciousness or awareness, that experience doesn't disappear when the experience actually ceases. After that experience is over, there is something remaining, a residual element left in the mental structure. And we call it memory. We call it impression. But that is only a very, very superficial way of explaining. It leaves a residual element in the mind. It is called in Patanjali system vritti. So what is vritti? In a way, it is beyond explanation. Suppose we experience something and it is very unpleasant. We may not want to remember, but we cannot help remembering that. So our willful effort not to remember that unpleasant event doesn't succeed. Our effort doesn't succeed. We are somehow forced to remember again and again what we do not want to remember. That's because the experience that we have leaves a residual element in the mental system. And that is called vritti. That vritti is a very complex phenomenon. That vritti can function in so many ways. Sometimes it could create complications. Many of the problems of phobia and obsessions and delusions due to some unpleasant vrittis that are associated with some unhappy experience which we want to forget, but we are not able to forget it. Now this vritti, it becomes a samskara, a tendency, and that samskara can also become a habit, what you call vasana, and this again will reflect in our reactions towards similar or opposite experiences in future. You may ask the question, what's the use of explaining this? That's why the commentators make a great contribution to modern psychology. That is, understanding the nature of vrittis will help us to get rid of the tyranny of vrittis. It will help us. Oh, vritti is natural. This memory, the impression that's left in the mental system, even after the experience is over, it is natural. Once we understand this, once we become aware of this, then the vritti will not have a devastating effect. It will become a lesser problem. It will become less of a problem. So that's why the commentator says, understanding the way our mind functions helps us to solve the problem, because we are equipped with the knowledge of how mind functions. Once we understand this, the tyranny, or you call the undesirable, unpleasant influence of unpleasant memories in the form of vrittis will not be a big problem. Because what happens, you know, our ability to understand nature will destroy the magnetic character of the mind. The mind, I said, so, you know, Vyasa's commentary is very important, you know. See, chittam ayastanta manikalpa means mind, mental system functions like a magnet. If you remove the magnetic property from that instrument, from that mind, then it won't be affected. Then the iron pieces or things around will not be drawn towards the magnet. So the magnetic property of mind can be removed. The natural tendency of mind to be attracted by, to be impacted, to be affected by all these experiences can be reduced by what? Through detachment, through a proper understanding. What's a proper understanding? According to Patanjali system, it's a constant remembrance of the fact that mind is not the whole of human personality. Mind is only a very insignificant aspect of our personality. Our true personality goes beyond mind, beyond intellect. It is, according to Patanjali system, Purusha or Atman, which cannot be and will not be affected by any of these events taking place around us. So, in other words, when you think of yourself as the Atman, as the Purusha, then the magnetic property of the mind to attract all the things around will be lost, because you won't interpret yourself to be the mind. You'll interpret yourself. You understand yourself as something that goes far beyond mind. So, that is the importance of this particular statement. That is, chittam ayaskanta mani kalpam sannidhi matropagari drishyatvena sumbhavati purushasya swaminaha. What it means is this. Mind is like a magnet. So by being fit to be seen and by being useful to its mere proximity, it becomes the property of its master. That means, that is the literal translation. What it means is this. The natural tendency of the mind is to be drawn towards various things. So when we see an object, our mind assumes the form of that object, and we interpret ourselves as the one who sees that object. Now, after that experience is over, we will continue seeing that object in our mind. After hearing something, even long after, we will continue hearing that word or that the sound mentally, at the mental level in our mind. That's why we are able to learn music. A music teacher teaches you something in the morning, and the evening you practice it, not seeing the book. Because what happens, you know, mentally you are hearing the instruction of the teacher, so naturally you are able to rehearse it. So mentally we see, mentally we smell, mentally we touch things, mentally we enjoy the taste of things. At the subtle level, mind itself projects experiences that it had gathered earlier with the help of the senses of perception. Normally, we see objects with eyes and mind. We hear things with ears and mind. We touch things with mind and sense of touch. We smell things with the sense of smell and mind. So everything happens with the help of mind. Mind is involved. Mind functions along with the five senses of perception in all experiences. Which means mind gathers impressions, memories, samskaras, vrittis. Now, what happens when you practice yoga? You are experiencing all. You are living ordinary life. You are doing your duty. You are working office, workplaces, different places. But if we can at the same time remember, mind is only an instrument for the real me. The real me is Atman. That's what Vedanta says. In a different language, yoga philosophy says, we are, our true nature is Purusha, the all-pervading reality, which goes beyond the mind, which goes beyond intellect. So the moment we interpret ourselves to be something that's beyond mind, then mind may participate in experiences, but the impressions and memories will not remain for long. Mind will lose its magnetic property. That's what really happens. So the fifth verse we already discussed, Klishtaha, Vrittaya Panchadaya, Klishtaha. This we already discussed. These vrittis are fivefold in nature. Certain vrittis which create long-standing effect, kleshas, as I mentioned, you know, there are many memories, impressions and experiences that we gather through our actions, which we may not experience, the result of which we may not experience in this life. They remain stored in a system called, Patanjali system. It is called Karmashaya, means a repository, a reservoir, where all impressions of actions remain stored, accumulated. Not only the impressions of actions we have performed, we have done in this life, but also various impressions or various actions we may have done in earlier lives. So yoga extends the scope of analysis beyond, backward, beyond the beginning of this life. So according to yoga, many of the conflicts that we face when we try to start a new life, when we try to meditate, or even when we try to bring about a change in our lifestyle, in spite of our best effort, best determination, our earnestness, very often we are not able to bring about a change in our life. We are not able to do things that we sincerely want to do, because some invisible force, which we cannot understand or explain, try to block the path, a mental block. Mental block is too superficial a term, but Patanjali, according to Patanjali system, it what really prevents us from starting a new life, from doing what we really want to do, even it's a very noble deed, very much needed, the real cause of the problem is the effect of accumulated actions, deeds and events that are stored up in the mental system. So this is called in a karma, vritti, samsara, chakram, the Patanjali system will call it, the cycle of wheel is like, you know, what we do produces an impression. it becomes a samskara, a strong tendency, and a strong tendency to act in a certain manner, and that again leads to the same action, and the same action produces an identical vritti, so these vrittis get concentrated and it becomes a solid character. So once we understand the true nature of how this happens, this karmasya will not bother you. Because once we understand that we are not just these mental systems alone, we are something that goes beyond the mind. The moment we interpret ourselves to be something that's far beyond the mind, that transcends the mind, then problems at the mental level will not be so intimidating, so devastating in their effect. So we have discussed this matter in the last class. Today we are to start the sixth sutra, Pramana Viparyaya Vikalpa Nidra Smritayaka. So this particular sutra it gives a list of the various types of vrittis, So you have to remember, the previous sutra, fifth sutra, says vrittis are of five kinds, fivefold. The sixth sutra gives a list of these five types of vrittis. So we have to remember what vrittis are. That is very important. Because the most important sutra in yoga system is yogaka chitta vritti nirodha. That's all. That's the definition of yoga. Yoga is nothing but cessation of vrittis. Which means what? It is stopping our natural tendency to identify with all the modifications and experiences that happen around us, and to assert our true nature, our freedom. That means our true nature is something that goes beyond mind, beyond intellect. It is not, we are not the weak, fluctuating entities that are affected by all these various events taking place around us. We are something beyond that. This is the real purpose of yoga. So for that, chitta was already explained. Now vrittis are explained. Pramana vibhirre vikalpa nidra smritayaka. So, pramana means perception. Pramana is the first and most important tool in Indian epistemology. In a way, in Aristotle, Plato, in Greek thought, everywhere, perception is the foundational tool in theory of knowledge. Theory of knowledge means epistemology, the study of the structure, the methods of valid knowledge. So perception means direct perception. What we experience at the empirical level, and then what remains steady without being contradicted by other experiences, it is called pramana. That is true, that is everywhere in all, both Greek epistemology, which is the Greeks, the ones who started, who are the founders of this system in Western tradition, and also Indian epistemology, which goes much more ancient, pratyaksha. The pratyaksha means, aksha means eyes. So that which is within our empirical purview, that you perceive, that you understand at the empirical level, with the help of mind and the senses of perception. So that's the first important source of vrittis. So whatever you experience out of direct perception, mental cognition, that's the most important and one of the foundational source of all vrittis. So we cannot have any vritti which doesn't have some link to our direct experience. That's why, memories and dreams are only repetitions of experiences we have gone through in waking state. Of course, repetition in a different at a different level, not exactly the same. But we cannot have any memory, we cannot have any vritti, and we also cannot have any dream experience, which is completely separate, or which is completely unconnected with our experiences in waking state. Whatever we experience in waking state, we experience in dream or memories with the help of mind, without these senses of perception, senses of action involved. In waking state, eyes are involved in walking, feet are involved, but in dream and memories, only mind is involved. So that's the first one. So before going to, Pratyaksha, Anumana. Anumana is inference. Anumana is also related to perception. You know, in the famous illustration, which is now accepted in modern Western epistemology, the old Indian logical system says, you know, if you see smoke in the mountain, it means there is fire. Smoke can never be dissociated, separated from the reality of fire. I mean, now you can have smoke without fire, modern technology. But in ancient times, you know, so that is called inference. So inference also is not unrelated to perception and verbal testimony. Verbal testimony is an important method of knowledge, tool of knowledge, epistemology, a tool of epistemology. I mean, ideas related to experiences recorded by men or women of experience. That's what verbal testimony means. So, in the yoga tradition, for example, there are great writings of great men and women who practice yoga, the Vedic sages, or those who have advanced, those who have reached an advanced level of yogic experience, what they have written down based on their own personal experiences. So, they are to be taken as authentic sources of knowledge. So one is direct perception, the second one is inference, the third one is verbal testimony. So verbal testimony is also related to direct experience. Inference also is related to direct experience. So these are the three important tools in yogic epistemology. To understand the real importance of yogic epistemology, you know, I can give just an idea of how elaborate this ancient epistemological system was. In India, there are six theistic systems of philosophy and six atheistic systems of philosophy. Many of these systems of philosophy have more than three epistemological tools. See, the ancient, there was ancient Indian materialists, and today also, we call accidentalists, modern scientists sometimes belong to that category. They say perception, direct perception, is the only source of knowledge. But literally, you cannot say, you don't say Einstein is wrong, because we have not experienced what Einstein experienced. So, in a way, modern science also accepts verbal testimony. And also, we all modern scientists also accept inference, but they claim that direct perception is the only source of epistemology in modern times. In ancient India, there were different systems of philosophy. The Jainas and these Bauddhas, Buddhist philosophers, they accept only two tools of epistemology: Ramanuja, Madhva, Sankhya, Yoga, all the system three, Nyaya system four, Prabhakara Mimamsa 5, Bhatta Mimamsa and Vedanta 6, Pauranikas 8 and Tantrikas 10. Anyway, I'm not going to those details. It means at the highest level, there were philosophers in India who accepted 10 epistemological tools. So I'm not going to those details. So the seventh sutra says there are three sources of valid knowledge according to yoga system. One is direct perception, second is inference, third is verbal testimony. If you got anything to ask, you can ask during interaction. Now, the eighth sutra explains the second vritti, viparyayo mithya jnana adadruva pradishtam. So what is viparyaya? Viparyaya is a false knowledge of a thing which does not correspond to its real form. So even if you have got a false notion about certain things which may not be genuine or real, that also can create a vritti, and that vritti can influence your action, thought currents and words and character. Of course, that particular vritti gets neutralized when we get the correct knowledge. So we stop with this sutra today. You can start a discussion, you can ask any question on the sutras we discussed today or any of these days, because there will be no classes for the next 2 weeks. So I'm sorry about it. So you can have a discussion on any of the subjects we discussed in general with yoga.
Forgetting with the memory, am I supposed to forget or just not be attached to it? I find that I probably want to remember the pain that I've been through just so I can learn from it and not do it again. Am I supposed to just keep it in my mind and not obsess, or forget it completely?
You mean certain unpleasant things which you want to forget?
Just what I learned from.
Yeah.
You know, because I've been through more than most people, I would say. But I don't obsess on it anymore, and it's helped me become a better person because I've learned from it.
But if you forget, it could be better for you, feel.
Would it be better for me to forget or just not obsess?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, now willful effort to forget without taking to higher yoga will not really work. Rather, anything that you deliberately want to forget, that memory comes back to you again and again. Mm-hmm. Because every time you first remember, then you try to forget. So conscious effort to forget anything will never succeed. So the example is given in one of the Yoga Sutra texts, you know. So I mentioned this earlier. A patient who was losing his hair went to a doctor. He wanted a medicine for loss of hair. So the doctor told him, you never think of an egg. So he thought, okay, fine. But then he was always making a deliberate effort not to think of an egg. So first you have to think of it, then only you should avoid thinking about it, you know. So it means he lost all his hair in no time. So really speaking, what we deliberately want to avoid remembering or want to forget, we will not succeed. What we do when we go to another, when we elevate ourselves to another level, yeah, then slowly this becomes irrelevant and you forget it.
Right.
That's an important point in yoga. In yoga, that's why yoga, chitta vritti nirodha, you know. How do we transcend these vrittis? When we ascend ourselves to a higher level, when we reach a higher level, then these vrittis are there, but they stop disturbing us. Because we are able to remain unaffected. If unpleasant, suppose a person who is trying to meditate, conflicting thought currents come to his emerge in his mind, he should not befriend them. He should not fight with them. He should look at them, approach them in a totally indifferent, unaffected way. Then you know these thoughts will vanish themselves. So if you deliberately try to fight with those thoughts, then they'll become very strong. Because either If you move towards those thoughts by befriending them, or if you antagonize those thoughts by avoiding them, in both cases, you are connecting with them. And every act of connecting with the thought will reinforce it. So what we do, we lift ourselves to higher, another level, then these conflicting thought currents will cease to be a disturbing problem. Then eventually you have forgotten it. That's what really happens.
So getting to the next level.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So these become irrelevant. Mm-hmm. When they become irrelevant, you stop connecting with them. Either by befriending them, identifying them, fine with them, or by antagonizing, by fighting with them. Because in both cases, you connect with them. So you stop connecting with them when you ascend yourself to another level. So either by contemplating on some higher idea. See, it is in Vedanta, this process is given, you know. See, even if you are common sense, we can become yogis. See, if you look at the world, you can see everything is changing. Attitudes of people, friends or enemies, our own health, our own nature, everything in this world is in a flux. So anything which is changing cannot be eternal, cannot be permanent, they are impermanent. Anything which is subject to changes is impermanent. And once we recognize their impermanence, then, you know, we transcend. We look for something more permanent. We transcend that level. So then we become irrelevant. Yes, that's it.
Thank you. So you mentioned earlier about the happiness and unhappiness being the same side, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, how do you, you know, live in a state of joy? Like, is the joy through prayer or friendship or just, you know, the joy of being alive? Is that something that you should not attach to also?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Happiness and happiness as two sides of the same coin. And we are here, in this context, we are referring to happiness and happiness at the sensory level, empirical level. There is a higher happiness, which is like a coin with only one side, which goes beyond the sensory feeling of happiness, which transcends both happiness and unhappiness at the empirical level. That's when we are able to look upon both happiness and unhappiness with same even-minded equanimity of mind. There is a special kind of joy which comes to a person who is able to look upon both happiness and unhappiness with an even mind, with an equanimity of mind. That should be a real goal.
So you don't know until you're unhappy and still happy.
Yes. That's why, you know, because once we realize the fact that happiness, the empirical level, when you get something, you become happy, and next moment we may lose it, then it becomes unhappy. So happiness always really not happiness. It is only the absence of unhappiness. At the empirical level, there is no real happiness. What we call happiness is nothing but the absence of unhappiness in reality. But the real happiness is something that goes beyond happiness and unhappiness at the lower level. That's the real higher happiness, which goes beyond the sensory level of sensory interpretation of happiness, good blissfulness. So in the Gita, in fact, the question that you are asking to me is discussed in the Gita in a very famous verse. That is, Sukham Atyandigam Yetad Buddhi Grahyam Atyandriyam. Sukham means happiness, joy. Here it means higher transcendental blissfulness, happiness. It is not just satisfaction, with the effect of getting something, which will cease to be when you lose it. So the real transcendental happiness is an experience that goes beyond the sensory level, even mental level. It stays alone. It is not just the absence of unhappiness It is pursuit to happiness, which comes through yoga or meditation, higher life, where your mental state is not affected either by good or bad experiences at the sensory level. Once we understand this, at least even intellectually, then we'll be able to look upon the happiness and happiness equation with a sense of equanimity. Because we know when you have a happy experience, you know after some time it may be to unhappiness. When you have an unhappy experience, you realize the fact it is not going to be a permanent state of experience. So you'll be less unhappy when you are going through a difficult time. Because you know, just as a happy experience is impermanent, so also an unhappy experience is equally impermanent. So you reach a kind of even-mindedness when going through both. It's called equanimity. And this is actually, this is the real purpose of all higher thinking, all higher spiritual traditions. It's clear, Diable? Clear?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're not suggesting that if we have a negative experience, it's possible to be totally unaffected by those negative experiences. It's possible with practice to have a broader, deeper perspective from which you can witness the action and the consequences of action. Yeah. I'm going to feel, if I lose someone who's close with me, I'm going to feel the pain of that loss, although maybe the duration of that pain could be shorter, or maybe the severity, the acuity of that pain could be less.
Yes, when we reach a higher level, our definition of even the very concept of being happy will change. Our very approach, our definition of happiness itself will change. At that time, we won't be overwhelmed with joy when something happy at every empirical sensory level happens. And also we won't be overwhelmed when something unhappy happens. Because when we start looking at the higher meaning, higher interpretation of happiness, what it means to be happy, then our whole approach and definition will change. Even that higher concept will help us to remain in a state of equanimity. So equanimity of approach is a natural result of all practices, all spiritual practices, good prayer. If we pray to God, and then if everything happens by the grace of God or with will of God, that helps you, that strong conviction helps you to look upon the unhappiness, unpleasant experiences with a state of equanimity, and also happy experiences with the same equanimity. So in yoga, that's what exactly yoga is aiming at. Yoga is giving only very psychological interpretation of that experience. When our definition of what it means to be happy itself changes. After all, a child's happiness depends upon getting a chocolate. When he grows up, his definition of happiness will be something higher. When he becomes a philosopher, a saint, it will be still higher than getting a job, getting anything else. So, as we evolve, our very understanding or definition of happiness, life as a whole will change. That's the idea.
If I may ask one more.
Please.
It seems obvious to me that having a yoga practice is helpful. I wonder if you could comment. comment about this, that there are different kinds of memory, different orders of memory. So there's a long-term memory, right? So when there's long-term memory, that memory tends to be more organized and more integrated memory. So if we have, let's say, people who are disturbed by memory, by maybe from trauma, that memory tends to be fragmented memory and not stored in long-term memory. So it continues to surface and upset us. I'm wondering if Vedanta or yoga practice aside, whether it's helpful to that it's psychologically, in the modern sense, psychotherapy, yeah, in the modern sense would be helpful as a way to, as a preparation for this larger yoga practice.
Yeah. Well, I can give an example from meditation. You know, what really happens in meditation? First of all, we are trying to ascend to a level higher than the physical body, even the mind. What happens? So all traumatic thought currents or unpleasant memories, torturing traumatic impressions coming from previous life, are related some way or other, one way or other, with the experiences involving mind and body, actually. Nothing beyond that. If such a person can start looking upon himself or herself as a transcendental, as Atman, as something higher than this body and mind, then you find the impact of these traumatic memories will be reduced. So when we ascend our consciousness to a higher level, then the problems belonging to the lower levels will become lesser problems. That's what really happens. No? So even, when we... Of course, this is what happens in prayer, for example. That's what exactly happens in prayer, according to Gandhi. You know, Gandhi used to arrange group prayers, congregational prayers, public prayers. Somebody asked Gandhi, you know, this prayer is something you have to do in solitude. You don't pray in public. In fact, the very idea of prayer in public, you know, is a really contradiction. So Gandhi asked... Gandhi was asked by one monk in India. He wanted to do this. So the Gandhi's answer was, it is true, but then to begin with, for the common people, even to develop the habit of turning to something higher than our own body and mind, all these circumstances of which we are part, you know, that itself is the first important step for higher prayer. So if somebody participates in this kind of prayer meetings, that person may eventually start praying in solitude, in his own inner world. So it becomes real inner prayer. That is Gandhi's answer. So somebody, he explained this in an article in Young India. You know. I mean, just pursuing this point, that means you are ascending yourself to your... You're ascending yourself to a higher level of your own entity. What you are? I mean, first, you are the one who participates in the public prayer meetings. Gandhi used to hold prayer meetings. And then finally, you become an inner contemplative prayer. So there is an ascent, there is a progression in that. Oh, please continue.
Yeah, I just want to clarify what you're saying. Are you suggesting that your prescription would be to have a yoga practice, Vedanta practice, instead of psychotherapy? Or is there some aspect of psychotherapy which is maybe important, again, preparatory to a larger practice?
No, I certainly won't deny its importance or relevance. No, I won't do, maybe along with that, I mean. Because very often it doesn't fully succeed in solving the problems. There are many areas where it may not fully, it doesn't fully succeed. I myself come across some people. So in such cases, not instead of it, but along with it, the higher spiritual orientation will be a great help. Because psychotherapy doesn't help you to ascend to your own level of consciousness. Our understanding of what we actually are, there is no change in that. Psychotherapy tries to solve mental problems at the mental level. So the solution is at the mental level, the problems are also at the mental level. If the solution has to be permanent, then the solution has to be on a higher level than the level of the problems. So ultimately, psychological problems cannot have fully effective, permanent psychological solutions. Psychological problems can only have permanent solutions at the spiritual level, where you go beyond psyche. I can give the example. If you are a great musician or a scientist, let's say a simple example. If you're a scientist, a dedicated scientist, like somebody like Einstein, Newton, there are seekers of truth, quest for truth, let us say. Or you are a great musician, classical musician. Suppose one day you have hurt your nail, or a thorn has pierced your feet. If you don't have any of this, you'll be crying and weeping, thinking about this. But if you're a great musician, you'll be listening to a great music or a master. If you're a great painter, you'll be enjoying great painting. If you're a great scientist, you can still enjoy playing the role of a scientist, even when there is pain in the body. But if you don't have any of this, you'll be at the physical level. So you find when you elevate your level of consciousness to a higher level than the physical, even physical problems appear to be lesser problems. Even forget physical problems. So also, if you can elevate yourself to a level beyond the psyche, then psychological problems can be solved. That's why psychological problems can have only impermanent psychological solutions. If you are going for permanent solutions, then psychological problems can only have spiritual solutions, which takes you beyond the psyche, beyond mind. So thank you. Now we have an announcement. Namaskar. So we will not have class next two Fridays, April 7 and April the 14th. So the next class will be on Friday, April the 21st at 7:30 p.m. I am sure that all of you will enjoy being directly present here asking questions. But in case you are not able to do, please remember all these classes are being live streamed. And the Yoga Sutra classes, the 70 classes are already available on YouTube and live stream. You can see the address from our bulletin, our website. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Paramastu.